I'm fond of saying that kids have a hole in their soul in the shape of their dad, that God whispers into the wombs of mothers that there's this one that will love them like no other. And if a father is unable or unwilling to fill that hole, it can leave a wound that's not easily healed. And I know that because I'm a wounded soul.
That's Roland Warren, CEO of CareNet, who will be the keynote speaker at the 10th annual RUC fundraising banquet. Join us on April 4th as we celebrate a decade of support. Make your reservations now at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.
March is coming in like a confused lion. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hey, Barry. Very good to be back with you in the studio. And yeah, you're right. Since this is our show for March the 2nd, 2019... March is coming in, although it's not going to be that confused for the first week. It's going to be, I think, 5 or 7 degrees on Tuesday. So it's pretty much not confused. It knows it's a lion. It's maybe a little later on where we're hopefully it's going to be more confused. Soon, I hope. I have to laugh about some things I'm seeing in the news. We were just laughing off the air. But before we go into that, folks, keep your calendars open for April 4th. That is, you'll probably hear some ads if you listen to WLRY, and if you listen to the front of our show, and if you listen to the back of our show, you'll hear an ad for the Relationships Under Construction Banquet. And we would like you to come and sit at our table. You can sign up at www.relationshipsunderconstruction.com. That's relationshipsunderconstruction.com. And tell them you want to sit at our table, and you can do that. You can also contact us, and we'll sign you up for that. But we'd like to have you come sit at our table. We're going to ask around, start putting people on the list. And we would like very much for you to be one of those. So April 4th at the Villa Milano, I believe the festivities start at 5:30 and the dinner starts at 6:30, if I remember correctly. And again, we'd very much like for you to be there. So keep it in mind, Relationships Under Construction is a very, very, very worthy cause. And we need your support. We've lost some of our grant money this year, and we do need your support. So please help us at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.
Okay, well, you've had your plug this morning. Now yeah. I get to have a chance to have my
now,
plug this
now
morning.
Now it's yours, yeah.
Okay, folks, I know it's Saturday, March the 2nd, and this is very short notice, but I think it's something that a lot of people would like to try to do, and you can do it fairly easily. And that is, how would you like to come and hear from national, international, and even local to the state of Ohio leaders in the pro-life movement give you tools in order to help you be a more effective advocate for life? Well, you can do that by coming to the nation's largest single conference on pro-life anywhere. It's called the Bringing America Back to Life Convention. It has become, in the last 10 years, the single largest pro-life event in the United States that is a convention, not the march and things of that nature. Yes, they get plenty of people there. But this is the largest convention for folks to come and network and to learn from leaders in the pro-life movement what's happening out in the field, both nationally and internationally, and why it's important for us to all get involved to promote the culture and ethic of life. It's going to be next weekend. It starts on Friday, March the 8th, and goes through Saturday, March the 9th. You can get passes to come. I don't know if there's any meal passes left, but you can get passes to come for either Friday or Saturday or for both days by going to bringingamericabacktolife.org. Bringing America Back to Life, all one word, no spaces, bringingamericabacktolife.org, and you can register for the convention. Now, Chuck, Why would they want to register for the convention? Well, because we have such speakers as, well, Star Parker, who's going to be the keynote for one of the full sessions. Nick Loeb, who is a producer and has written a movie that's getting ready to come out that Hollywood is all a buzz about. But they're only a buzz about it because they want to stop it from happening. It's the Roe v. Wade movie. So this is a pro-life movie that they had to shoot and film basically undercover. And if you remember, there was a situation where when certain cast members and even crew members found out what the movie was about, they quit the movie because they're pro-abortion, locked into the Hollywood mindset. Well, Nick's going to be there talking, and I think we're going to get a little preview of some of the movie. So that's exciting. Ryan Anderson from the Heritage Foundation, who's going to be talking about the issues regarding the transgender movement. and somebody that's known to you and I both, Chuck, and you might want to come up for this. Alan Keyes, former U.S. ambassador, is coming to speak at Bringing America Back to Life. Now, you know, you and I have talked about Dr. Keyes before, but, you know, when it comes to pro-life issues, he has been a strong national voice for solid pro-life movement. Now, you and I maybe have some differences with him on some of the constitutional framework issues, but otherwise, he's been very good. We also have Judith Reisman, and for those of you who are in the know, Judith Reisman is a dynamo. She basically has spent most of her entire professional career as a researcher and an attorney trying to deconstruct the myth around the Kinsey Report and the sexual progressive movement. And so she's going to be talking more about what's going on with that. And frankly, that's the one I'm looking forward to going and sitting and listening to and getting a chance to talk with Dr. Reisman. Now, again, folks, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. There are breakouts all day long on both Friday and Saturday, and then there's a luncheon keynote and a dinner keynote speaker. And, you know, no shame in saying this. This is also acts as these dinners act as fundraisers for Cleveland Right to Life, who is the primary sponsor. Molly Smith up there, their president, puts this on, coordinates this whole thing, puts on one of the most fantastic conferences you've ever been to. And it's just absolutely incredible to see so many people who are dedicated to the ethic of life together in one place from all over the country. I mean, I talk to our pro-life colleagues and break bread with them and talk over strategies for folks from Georgia, Wisconsin, New England, California, everywhere. And we have, like I said, international speakers as well from South America, from Europe. It's a fantastic time, and folks, it's not that expensive either. I don't know off the top of my head exactly how much the registration. Of course, I should probably look that up, and should have known this ahead of time. Ah, here it is. If you just want to do the speakers, it's only $25 a day, and that's to get all of the six major breakouts during each day. Now, if you want to add food, I guess there is still some food available, and those are at varying rates. But again, go to bringingamericabacktolife.org to find out all about it. Now, if you get if you want the all access pass, which includes all the breakfast, the lunch, the gala dinners, and the speakers, it's $140. So, again, a fantastic and very affordable rate. It's going to be in Cleveland, actually Independence, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland, at the Embassy Suites Hotel. So, again, it's the same place we've been to for the last 10 years, so it's a very familiar space if you've ever been there before. And we're also going to have some other folks show up, legislators who are supporting going to be moving the heartbeat bill here in Ohio, so you can meet with those legislators as well. So that's my plug, Chuck.
Well, both excellent plugs, both excellent things.
But now that we've got all of this wonderful, you know, positive stuff out of the way, now we turn into why March is like a confused lion, and it's mainly the political end of the world of March being a confused lion.
Definitely.
So, I mean, you almost have to laugh at some of this, Charles. I think the funniest thing, and kind of we'll start from the most recent and kind of back up a little bit. The most recent thing, obviously, on everybody's radar politically right now are the, I believe it's, what is it, the House Investigative Committee or House Oversight Committee that is holding hearings, and they've invited a special speaker in. And, Chuck, you know a lot about this, so you want to share for everybody what's going on here.
Well, they invited him. They didn't invite him. They subpoenaed him. I guess that's a form of an invitation.
I'm still use the word invite because, you know, I think the subpoena was political theater.
Oh, absolutely. Of course it was.
Because I believe that there's something else going on here. It isn't the... This isn't a hostile witness that they had to force to come in. So,
well, if you'll recall, if you know anything about the hearings, essentially, Rashida Tlaib, who's from Michigan, made a direct accusation of racism against Mark Meadows, Representative Mark Meadows from North Carolina, I'm pretty sure, in the committee hearing. Why? Because he had invited as a guest a woman named Lynn Patton, who was a black woman and who was a friend of Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen is who got invited, subpoenaed / invited by the Democrats to come testify to the committee. Well, Tlaib came right out, and because he had invited this woman, she accused him directly of being a racist. And I'm not sure how racism was involved, but eventually Tlaib was forced to issue an apology to Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
for that. Now, first of all,
let me jump in here if I might. I'll tell you exactly how racism was involved in this and why that charge was thrown. Because the entire setup around the individual testifying to Congress was they were testifying that the president is actually a closeted racist and has been a racist for years. And having a person of color, this young lady, who has worked for Trump for that same number of years or pretty close to it, to basically be the physical presence counteracting the, well, allegations might be a nice way of putting it. I'd say outright lies being spewed by the witness really kind of set the Democrats off, because it was basically throwing off their meme. That's why Meadows bringing Powell in was racist. That was a racist move because that's the only card they could play to try to smear every... If you think about this, Chuck, the left, the progressive Democrat left, their biggest weapon is using smear attacks to try to discredit someone from the get-go without any facts behind it. It's the worst form of identity politics you can possibly engage in, but that seems to be the only card they have in their hand to play.
Well, it's very interesting to read. This is from an article out of the Conservative Treehouse, and this is the place to go if you really want to kind of try to put together all the dangling ends of the whole Trump Russia collusion debacle story / fiction piece. The Conservative Treehouse has been very good at putting together all the pieces and making them fit, especially the articles written by a fellow named Sundance, a fellow or a woman. Nobody knows who Sundance is, by the way. Sundance is a nom de plume, and nobody knows who this person is. I'm guessing whoever the editor is of Conservative Treehouse does. But then again, you never know, because sometimes you don't know. But anyway, there's a quote here from Lynn Patton that makes everything clear, I think, about why Michael Cohen has done such a 180 on Trump. And here's what she says, quote, "Many of you may already know that I am considered Michael Cohen to be one of my very best friends. Countless people can confirm that we were virtually inseparable during my employment at Trump, and that he is single-handedly responsible for introducing me to the Trump family and effectively changing my entire life. I would be lying if I didn't admit that my heart still breaks for him and for his family, with whom I have grown extremely close. What many of you may not be aware of is the fact that I can personally confirm that the only reason, and only is emphasized, Michael Cohen turned on the President of the United States is because Mueller threatened to throw his wife in jail for up to 30 years, period. She is the co-guarantor of a $20 million personal loan that Mueller discovered Michael secured back in 2015 by falsely inflating the value of his taxi medallions, effectively making her part and parcel to the federal charge of making false statements to a financial institution, to which Cohen ultimately pled guilty. This is also the reason why Cohen's longtime taxi medallion partner, Evgeny Gene Friedman, was granted immunity." In other words, Cohen, who clearly is a fraudster, defrauded his wife.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, and made her liable for up to a possible 30-year prison sentence. Now, would she actually serve 30 years? The answer would be no. Even if they found a friendly judge would look at the evidence and say, "Are you kidding me?" She'd get a fine and a suspended jail sentence, most likely. But nonetheless, she was threatened with that, and Cohen, understanding that what he had done, decided to protect his wife and family rather than protect his client. In other words, he was given what's known as a Hobbs choice by a federal prosecutor. And this is the way federal prosecutors work, in case you didn't know that.
I'm not very familiar. I've never had to deal with a federal prosecutor.
Well, I am close to a case where that actually happened.
Wow.
I am fully aware of someone who was under a federal prosecution for a dubious charge.
We can say that.
Yeah, having to do with dietary supplements.
Oh, we can definitely say that.
And that person was told that as part of a plea agreement that he would have to testify before a grand jury, which he didn't want to do, but he agreed to do it. And he agreed to do it on the basis that they said, "You have to help us." And he says, "I will come in and testify to the facts and nothing else." Well, and by the way, this person, I had to laugh. I remember watching the news coverage, and federal prosecutors came out and said he had made this gigantic sum of money. And I laughed because I knew what the numbers were. He said he made over $500,000 last year. And I said, "No. His sales were $500,000. Anybody who knows anything about a business, you can have $500,000 in sales, and you didn't make anything like $500,000. And that was the case in this case. But, of course, federal prosecutors try cases in the press. They taint jury pools. As we've seen in a lot of these Trump cases, Mueller has done the same thing. Mueller has used the power of the press, his friendly press, to say things that were just unbelievable, and to do things like, if you recall, I don't want to get too far afield, but Roger Stone. Roger Stone was an advisor in the early days to the Trump candidacy. He's a longtime friend of Trump's, a business associate, and was under some kind of, he's being prosecuted, and they're doing the same thing to him. They're trying to force him to flip on the president and make up a bunch of stuff, like as Cohen just did. And they raided his home with 27 FBI agents in full SWAT gear, except for the ones who were in, get this, Barry, who were in aquatic SWAT gear, because there was a creek behind Stone's house, and they were afraid that he might try to jump in the creek and swim away. So they had the full water gear on, and they had aquatic vehicles, you know, things that could go in on both land and the water,
sure.
amphibious vehicles. The whole thing. That 27 guys to arrest a 66-year-old man who came to the door in a pair of gym shorts and a T-shirt.
So, in other words, they went full G.I. Joe against the guy that they're acting like is Cobra Commander.
Well,
I love it.
But the beauty of it is, what they do, who did they leak it to that they were going to do this?
CNN.
CNN. Because, what do you know?
Because they know they'd get the spin.
They know they'd get the right spin. This is how federal prosecution works. Okay, so this fellow that I know was brought before a grand jury, and he was a Christian, and he prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed that they would ask him the right questions in the right way. And the prosecutor who's, you know, asking the questions before the grand jury, this person said, it was as if I had written the question for the prosecutor. They asked me just the right questions in just the right way, and I was able to tell the whole story. And about halfway through his testimony, they literally asked for a recess and dragged him into a side room with the door open so that the grand jurors could hear it, and berated him. I mean, screaming at him that he was not only not helping their case, he was harming them. And he said, I did not agree to lie for you. I agreed to tell you the facts. If the facts crumble your case, that's your thing. Now,
absolutely, it's their thing. That's right.
Are you going to let me finish my testimony, or are you going to pull me? Well, the prosecutor had no choice but to allow him to finish his testimony, which she cut as short as possible. Why? Because this was not happening. Now, what was the actual outcome? Well, this person eventually went in, and the federal prosecutors reneged on their plea deal. I told him, this person, I said, hey, you need to withdraw your not guilty plea and go to a jury trial. And he said, I can't afford it. Because what federal prosecutors do is break you financially. It costs tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to go through a full federal trial. So what they do is they make it impossible. This is why you saw guys like Michael Flynn. When the judge begged Michael Flynn not to take the plea deal, are you sure you don't want to withdraw your plea? And he said no. Why? He had no more money. He had already had to sell his house to pay his attorneys. He had no more money to cover a trial, which there would have been, and he would have been found not guilty. The judge made that rather clear when he sentenced Michael Flynn, that it was a travesty of justice, but he had pled guilty. Why? Because he was given no choice. This is how federal prosecutions work. Okay? This is what happened to Cohen. Cohen is cut off from his source of revenue. Now, I don't know if you know anything about taxi medallions.
Not much, no.
That is essentially how you can run taxi services in New York.
Aha. Uh-huh.
They're extremely valuable. It's impossible to get a taxi medallion unless you're deeply connected.
Okay.
And so having a number of those is extremely valuable. So basically, he used the value of those and overestimated on purpose their value, which is what got him the whole fraud thing. Okay, so what do we got here? We got a guy who violated his attorney-client privilege unnecessarily. He was not unmasked by a court. He simply did it on his own under pressure from and out of control and not really regulated at all federal prosecutor in Robert Mueller, who has a history, by the way, of doing this. This is not in the midst of all this going on. Mueller is called before a FISA court for defrauding a FISA court in a different case several years ago. So Mueller has a track record of defrauding FISA courts, in which case he has done it here as well. And that will come out. But the fact is, this woman is making the direct charge, and she's, I from what I know about federal prosecutions, she's absolutely right. Cohen had no choice, because his wife would be joining him in jail, but they would not be sharing the same jail cell. So this is what's frightening. This is the country we now live in. You are financially broken by any federal officer who basically decides to get you, can get you. Why? Because you cannot afford to undergo, if you're an average citizen, unless you have independent means of finance, you will be broken by the attorney's fees, period. Now, we've seen that in the some of the guys in the Patriot movement. There are all kinds of attempts to sue people into compliance by big players. One of the reasons that groups like is happening with the whole case down in Kentucky, who'd they file suit against? The Washington Post? $250
yes,
million? Dollars?
Washington Post.
The reason that they filed against only one at a time is they don't want everybody ganging up, because everybody knows that they just simply hire the best lawyers they can get and break you financially.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Discovery, 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 discovery. I've been through that process. Believe it or not, a trademark issue. And they sent in some high-powered attorney. And I sat for hours being, and the woman asked me questions that at one point I looked her in the eye. She made an accusation. You said this. And I said, where did I say that? Oh, well, strike the question. I'm like, no, I want it on the record. So eventually my attorney asked for disclosure of something that would be highly embarrassing to the corporation. And all of a sudden, all the tens of thousands of dollars that went in on their end to fly this attorney to Columbus so we could, go through this deposition and blah, 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 blah. It all went out the window. Well, you can't trademark it, but you can use a common law trademark. Okay, fine. But you can't claim it's for this. I go, we never claimed it was for that. Oh, okay. So, I mean, that's the kind of nonsense that you go through. Attorneys, I'm not a big fan of attorneys, Barry. Case could tell. But they're a necessary evil. I like good ones. I like ethical ones. And I go to church with a man I can consider to be an ethical attorney, and that's a topic for another discussion. But we're not seeing too many ethical attorneys at work. There's a lot of attorneys at work in the House Oversight Committee, but not too many of them are ethical. Let's put it that way.
Well, that's likelihood, yeah. But the one person who is very ethical is Ohio's own Congressman Jim Jordan, who basically had a field day during the hearings, lambasting both the witness and the chairman of the committee, Elijah Cummings, for basically creating a dog and pony show and bringing in someone to testify as a star witness who has been indicted, convicted, and will be going to prison for lying to Congress. Now, Chuck, you can't make these stories up. You know, you just can't.
Well, there's another facet.
Democrats took control of the House of Representatives in January. And here it is at the end of February, and they're already bringing in individuals who have already been convicted of lying to Congress in a previous testimony and are going to prison for it to come in and testify to Congress again, all for the simple fact that they are hoping that his ginned up testimony, which they coached. Come to find out that he admitted it on the stand, that he had consulted with both Cummings, who's the chair of that committee, and Adam Schiff, who is the chair of the larger oversight committee, about his testimony before he gave it. Chuck, if this would have been a Republican chairman sitting down with someone who was pro-Trump and talking over his testimony before he gave it, Do you realize exact the cry, the pitch, the howl that would be coming from the leftist Democrats on how this the testimony was then perjured and was a show testimony and was staged and it was all an act. But what we have now is Elijah Cummins, who has been there for a long, long, long time. And I know you and I both have kind of different takes on the term limits thing, but he would be a poster child for the reason why federal term limits would be a good idea. But you got a situation where Cummins is like, oh yeah, he's credible, and you know I think Trump has committed crimes based on what Cohen has said, and it's like, okay, folks, you know, and since you've just unpacked the whole thing that perhaps he was saying these things under duress of Mueller and federal prosecutors holding a sword of Damocles over the head of his wife, it just goes to show you that things are not all well in the Democrat caucus. And Chuck, we know that for a fact because the cracks lines are showing right now. And it's funny. It's not even over the Cohen thing. Okay. They've had some serious crack lines that have shown over gun issues. Now, I think this is a very interesting piece. Because what happened here is there was a move this week. The Democrats were bringing forth a bill to basically increase gun control. Okay, this would require background checks on all gun sales, including private ones. Okay. Well, this was a Democrat. This is one of their things they're after, you know. So they bring this bill up, and they're moving it forward. And then the Republicans in Congress, who I'd have to say, Chuck, at this point in time, it's starting to look like the Republicans are starting to understand procedural moves can work to advance your cause. Because the Democrats have been playing them for years while they were in power. With the same type of thing, but now here they're coming. So basically they moved to amend the bill to require ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to basically be informed if if you're going to have background checks, if the background check comes up that the person trying to buy the gun is in the country illegally, then that's supposed to be flagged immediately to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Well, you'd think that'd be an amendment that would die on the face of it, right? Democrats control Congress, right? They have the majority in the House of Representatives, and they have a fairly comfortable majority. Their problem is that 26 Democrats voted with the Republican caucus, and that amendment went into their gun bill, their gun control bill. Oops.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that has created a lot of furor because this isn't the only thing that's happened. There's also been a couple of situations where they've been bringing forward bills. I think one of them was an immigration bill. And the Republicans made a procedural motion called an MTR, a motion to recommit. In other words, to send it back to committee to tweak it some more, to add an amendment or something to it. And the number of moderate Democrats have voted in favor of it. And so the Republicans are winning on procedural votes because the House Democrat caucus isn't voting like a monolith right now. Of course, that has spurred Speaker Nancy Pelosi to basically call the family into a closed-door caucus meeting. And this happened, this is Friday morning we're recording this. This just happened yesterday, where she basically yelled at these members that this isn't a day at the beach, this is the Congress of the United States, basically not pleading with them, but threatening them to stay unified and to vote as a block on all these things. But even Nancy Pelosi doesn't have full support for that position because her two chief lieutenants, Steny Hoyer, who is the number two in command, majority leader, and Jim Clyburn, the South Carolina majority whip for Pelosi, disagree with her. They believe that the Democrats on certain votes should be allowed to break party ranks because of, well, the political considerations of their districts. And it's interesting because there's an article in Politico today on this. It was written by Heather Cagle and John Bresnahan. And I think it's hilarious because it just kind of shows how this whole thing unwinds. And it actually exposes a couple of things. First of all, it exposes that Nancy Pelosi doesn't have a iron grip on her own caucus. And she's arguing they've got to stick together on these procedural votes, whereas Hoyer and Clyburn are basically saying that, you know what, if it's going to improve them politically, i.e., it's going to keep them from getting ads run against them when they go to run for re-election that they were opposed to this, then it's a procedural vote. Let them vote. It's not finalizing the bill. Let's let them vote on it. So, well, here it goes. You know, this situation has opened the door for the Republicans to really be able to create some chaos within the Democratic caucus, which I have to say is, be careful what you wish for. You might just get it.
Yeah,
exactly. To Nancy Pelosi, because she wanted power so badly. She wanted control. Well, she's got it, and she's getting exactly a measure of the opposition that they gave to Republicans when the Republicans were in control. So now they're talking about changing the rules to basically, you know, keep the majority members from going off the reservation. Of course, that would create its own group of issues. Now, the second thing that it shows is that not only does she have problems on her, I would call the right of the Democratic Party, i.e., these moderate slash somewhat conservative Democrats in districts who are like, you know what, you live in a border district or something, we can't be soft on illegal immigration, we can't be soft on illegals getting guns, so we're voting with the puppies on this. She's also got problems from her left wing, because, yep, sure enough, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has decided and publicly announced that she's going to keep an enemies list. Chuck, you remember the old enemies list,
gosh,
right?
Richard Nixon.
Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
The enemies list of people who were opposed to his whatever his administration was doing. Well, Ocasio-Cortez is going to keep an enemies list, and she's announced that she would alert progressive activists when Democrats are voting with the Republicans on these type of motions. In other words, she's going to gin up protests in these moderate Democrat districts against them for breaking party
unity. Yeah.
So if Pelosi lets that run, she's definitely going to have a schism in her caucus with the moderates and the conservative Democrats who are going to be looking at her like, no. We are incumbents. You are duty bound as Speaker to protect our interests. But then again, if she calls Ocasio-Cortez down, this young firebrand will probably attack her.
More than likely, yeah.
More than likely. So, you know, here's the deal that I think Nancy Pelosi is finally figuring out that the only thing you can do with power once you get it is lose it.
Well, that's an interesting way of thinking about that. But, yeah, you're right.
The only thing you can do with power once you obtain it is lose it. Everybody thinks, well, I'm growing my power. No, if you have power, you have power. You're just multiplying the areas in which you are exerting that power. But the problem is that every time you exert power, you lose power.
Well,
every time Nancy Pelosi has to go to the well and force the hand, and she has to enact what would be considered party discipline against her own caucus, for doing the things that they know that they need to do, she loses power. Her argument was, we're either a team or we're not, and we have to make that decision. I would have to say, Chuck, that she's not. She's a little oblivious to the fact that it looks like that decision has already been made. And the answer is, you're not a team.
Absolutely.
And that's the problem with identity politics. That's the problem with radical leftist orthodoxy is, and we're finding that out in many areas. I mean, look at Martina Navratilova, an openly lesbian, you know, ex-tennis player, was critical of the transgender movement of, you know, transgender guys competing against girls in professional and collegiate sports. And she's now become a pariah because she's not towing the line.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if
you
recall,
the same thing that's happening to Nancy Pelosi. You know, if you've got Ocasio-Cortez and they're basically going to create an enemies list of her own colleagues, you got Rashida Tlaib, you know, attacking everybody coming and going. You have Ilhan Omar, who now, the funny thing is, has come out and said that anybody who supports, is a supporter of Israel, is becoming an agent of a foreign country. And Chuck, that's not a, you know, loose phrase she's throwing around.
No, that has
that's a phrase that has behind it the potential of indictments and investigations for, you know, illegal activity.
That has a legal definition.
Yes, it does. It's just absolutely plain as the nose on your face that the Democrat caucus is in meltdown mode. They are obsessively focused on getting Trump no matter what, but along the way their entire caucus is falling apart like a disintegrating old piece of, you know, paper. And well, it's interesting to watch.
Think about this, Barry. When you know, you brought up Nancy Pelosi. If you recall, they had to delay the vote for Speaker.
Yes, they did.
And
why?
The reason, yeah, because Nancy didn't have the support to take the job.
And why didn't she have the support?
Because of this block of radicals who basically had enough votes to what would there was actually talk of having to get Republicans to vote for her.
Exactly.
Because they'd rather see her because thinking that she's extremely dangerous, which she is. But look at this pack that she's got to basically. This is a pack of ravenous wolves who are basically being restrained by a wire fence. Well, how long do you think that's going to last?
Not much longer, especially if they start moving toward impeachment.
Right.
If their entire goal is to try to impeach the President of the United States, I have a very strong feeling that that's where the wire will snap, and you will basically have open rancor within their own caucus over issues, because they're not going to vote unanimously on that either. You got too many moderate Democrats in pro-union districts who love Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly.
It is going to be an awful hard sell if Michael Cohen is the best you can come up with as your rationale for filing charges of impeachment against a sitting president.
Look,
who has got the highest approval rating in the second year of any president in modern history, who has done more things in fulfilling the promises he made when he ran for office than any president, I think, since Calvin Coolidge. And who, honestly, is looking at going into a 2020 election cycle with the wind at his back.
Yeah.
And I think this is, but I just want to take a real quick second because I want to point out one thing that in this article that I thought was extremely telling. And it's this whole idea about this, about the split between Pelosi and Hoyer and Clyburn. Obviously, Pelosi believes that our Democrat platform or our Democrat philosophy principles, we have to have orthodoxy on. You have to vote as a bloc on all the things that the Democrats are pushing. So, amnesty for illegals and gun banning and transgender rights and forcing the Pentagon to, you know, go to the transgender thing even against the president. Hoyer and Clyburn are a couple of the old-timers, and they're basically saying that, you know, no, we have to be able to be flexible. Now, They said, and their quote was that the moderate members can vote with Republicans if they think it will improve their political standing. Now, if you wanted to be generous about that, you'd say, okay, they're saying if they know their district and it would be very bad for them in their district to not vote on these this way, that's fine. But you can also read that another way is it doesn't matter what their district thinks. If they think it'll give them an advantage in the election some way, somehow, we can let them do whatever they want because that's all that really matters is winning the elections. I know maybe I'm being a little bit too cynical about that, but you know, I've been around for a while. And I also just saw another example on a similar bill at the state level. You know, Chuck, I think we talked about this in a prior, that there was a quote-unquote drafting error when they passed the gun bill last...
Yeah, Hold on. You can't bring people in like that because a lot of people don't know a gun bill got passed last session.
Okay, basically a bill at the end of last session that would basically protect gun rights a little bit more strongly than we do right now. There's a drafting error. It was House Bill 228. There was a drafting error that got into it in the final version from the attorneys who do the drafting. They admitted they made a mistake, but their mistake was they pulled some language from a previous iteration of the bill that shouldn't have been there, and it had the effect of basically saying that, you know, if you own a rifle or a shotgun, which are not ones that you have to fill out background checks for, you know, regular rifles and shotguns, not what we consider high-capacity magazine things, that if you didn't register those, you could basically be charged with criminal possession of an illegal firearm. Well, that's, if you think about Ohio, Chuck, we have 11.7 or 8 million people in the state. There are probably at least 3 to 4 million people who own one of those type of firearms, at least.
Yeah, at least.
So you're talking about 3 or 4 million people who, if you went to your sporting goods store or Walmart or wherever it was you bought it, and you bought your Remington 12-gauge shotgun, or you bought your kid a 22-410 combo rifle, well, under that, you would be, if you possessed that, you could go to jail for it. Well, they knew they had to fix that. So this session, they brought emergency legislation up just last week to pass it. But the point is that because it was an emergency, you need to have 66 votes. Or excuse me, 67. Votes.
Yeah.
67 votes in the House in order to pass it. And you have to have like 21 or 2, I think 21, in the Senate to pass it. Well, the Senate passed their version, you know, without a problem. It was the House's turn to pass their version. And so what happened was on Tuesday, this vote happened Wednesday, and it passed. And it passed with like 78 votes. Why? Because the Republican Speaker of the House, Larry Householder, made a request and walked in to the Democrat caucus meeting on Tuesday night with all the Democrats in the House sitting there and made a pitch to them about getting enough votes to get this done. And the Democrat leadership, who I think voted almost as a block, the four of them, against the bill, against this emergency fix, basically realized that, yeah, for many of the folks in their districts, that, you know, this is a procedural vote to fix a clerical error. The bill's already passed. Frankly, it'd be a problem. Yeah, okay, so fine. You know, we'll talk to the Speaker. I don't know if the Speaker promised them any consideration on anything else, if it was a trade-off, or he just like went to ask them to do the right thing. But he ended up getting 17 Democrats coming across the island voting for this fix. So does the new Democrat House leadership have a problem? No, because they sit there and talked it out and realized, yeah, you know what? You know, when it comes to bigger bills on guns, we're probably going to try to get them all to vote as a caucus. But on something like this, you know, we're going to go ahead and give flexibility and let them vote the way they need to vote. So that's how you fix it. But Nancy Pelosi, she calls her caucus in and she berates them for doing just that. It's going to be interesting to see how that's going to pan out, Chuck, because I honestly think that Pelosi's grip on power is steadily declining.
Well, you know, the real question is, how's this going to play out in 2 years? That's the real question, because Nancy Pelosi has a track record of not remaining speaker very long.
Well, I think she's going to continue her pace. Yeah, I think her track record is going to be it's hold up.
I honestly think the last election was a fluke. I think a lot of people stayed home that shouldn't have because they got cowed. Either they got complacent or they got cowed. I could be wrong on that. The election, for instance, in my congressional district, was essentially with a guy that nobody really likes all that much. I mean, he's a likable fellow, but as a representative, he's really he's a cipher. There's just really not much there, and that's a oh gosh. You know who I mean. Took Pat Tiberi's place. See, I can't even remember his name.
Troy Balderson. Yep.
And he's essentially a sock puppet for leadership. Well, that doesn't play very well. One thing about Tiberi was he was leadership. So he didn't have to play sock puppet. But Balderson's a sock puppet, sadly. And we had a chance to replace him, and we couldn't get it done. But that election was much closer than it should have been. And I don't think it's going to be that close on the next one. I don't think the demographics in this district are changing all that much. Now, also, we'll see what happens when redistricting comes out, because we made the horrible decision to change the way we redistrict seats in Ohio. A lot of people don't realize that.
Yes, because it's going to take effect after the next census.
Exactly. So after the 2020 census, which is next year. So it'll really have an effect on the 2022 election, not so much the 2020, because the numbers won't be all in yet. But it'll definitely affect the 2022 election. And you watch, it's going to be a nightmare. There are going to be people scrambling to repeal this amendment to the Ohio Constitution. And that's really hard to do. But that being said, I don't think, honestly, I think this is turning into a debacle. Essentially, the Democrats are exposing what their core values are. The bad part is that the Republicans have been exposing what their core values are for years, and it has driven people into not voting because there's no candidate to vote for. You can either vote for a radical leftist or a squished middleman. Because that's what you get in a lot of cases. That's your choice.
Well, that's the reason why people have to start working early to identify good candidates to actually encourage them to run.
Yeah, exactly. And get involved in groups that are raising money and pushing some of these decent candidates and are vetting them. That's the problem. There aren't enough people on our side of the aisle who are, we tend to be, our side tends to be people who are busily involved in running their businesses or going to work every day, raising their families, and we don't have time to go out and march and do radical things and just in general raise a stink. We tend to elect representatives who we think are going to represent our values in Washington or in the Capitol in Columbus, and when they don't, then we get mad. But the problem is that we don't have the horsepower, we don't have the unity to go out and get rid of these people. So we're either stuck with them, or the other side, which is far more organized, gets out there and gets their radicals elected. Think in terms of the recent election in Westerville.
Yes.
Good example. And Gonzalez replaced by an upstart who and Gonzalez was grossly overconfident. Hey, no, you know, a Democrat hasn't been elected in this district in, you know, since, you know, the American Revolution.
Yeah,
and that didn't work out because she got lazy and she got beat And good riddance, by the way.
She did. You know, it's very interesting, Chuck. I was doing a little bit of research yesterday for a conference call that I'm doing later today. And I come to find out, I found out about a new group out there that I hadn't heard of before. But once I've heard of them, I'm like, oh, well, I get it now. And I'm starting to see what their game plan is. And the group is a PAC. It's an Ohio-based political action committee. Now, folks, keep that in mind. Political action committees. This is a very interesting one because the name of the action committee is, as I pull this up here, as soon as I get to it, there it is. It's called MatriotsOhio.com. Matriots, okay? Now, what does that sound like to you, Chuck?
Well, it sounds like matriarchs who were patriots.
Well, yes. Or that they're overthrowing the patriarchy.
That's exactly what
it is. This is an Ohio-based PAC that is endorsing candidates to support women in office. Now, that sounds like, okay, fine, you know, you got an interest, you like women in office, da-da-da-da-da. But basically, they call themselves a nonpartisan political action committee. They're
based
in Columbus.
Come on.
Yeah, okay, well, keep going. That's right, because that's the whole point. The Matriots was founded after six Central Ohio women participated in the Women's March on Washington in January.
Oh, my gosh.
And they have the list of the people who were involved in this, and I'm seeing some names. Sally Crane, who is with Crane Plastics. Kathy Kobacker, I believe, is fairly significant. These are women who have lots of money, okay? April Zimmerman Katz. There are these folks. These are leftist liberals with large bank accounts, all right? And so they've come together to basically to create a force to elect more women to public office to, quote, support economic justice for women and address our country's political stalemate. And so they, you know, I mean, they're a full blown. They've got everybody going. They've got, you know, they got a big board. Oh, yeah, I'm seeing folks. Now, again, they're bored. They've got folks from both political parties. But when you go to look at their endorsements, it's all Democrat, leftist, pro-abort women. It's just incredible to look at their class. And they were pretty successful, Chuck. Okay? They got quite a few in. Nikki Antonio in the Senate, who openly lesbian, has been attacking all the pro-life stuff for years, is the sponsor of the SOGI, the Sexual Orientation Gender Identity Bill that they're trying to push right now. Teresa Fetter over in the Senate. Sandra Williams. And then in the House, Kristen Boggs, who's now in Democrat leadership. Randy Kleitz, Erica Crawley. Tavia Galonsky, Bridget Kelly, Mary Lightbody, Beth Liston, Jessica Miranda, Allison Russo. These people are all now sitting in office at the state level, Chuck.
And
that whole list, and every one of these, and every one of these folks I named to you, every last one of them are pro-abort.
Yep. And leftist, this is exactly
social justice warriors.
You just basically laid out what I laid out earlier as we close today. We, because we're not as organized, either get stuck with the choice of a squish middle or a radical. And they have both parties on their board, which means nothing. All they have is a bunch of squish middles on their board.
Well, you got to remember, sometimes when you're doing this, you have to throw on a token.
Yeah.
A member of an opposite political persuasion.
Well, that being said, you know, we want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. Please join us April 4th at the Villa Milano for the Relationships Under Construction Banquet, and join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.
I'm fond of saying that kids have a hole in their soul in the shape of their dad, that God whispers into the wombs of mothers that there's this one that will love them like no other. And if a father is unable or unwilling to fill that hole, it can leave a wound that's not easily healed. And I know that because I'm a wounded soul.
That's Roland Warren, CEO of CareNet, who will be the keynote speaker at the 10th annual RUC fundraising banquet. Join us on April 4th as we celebrate a decade of support. Make your reservations now at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.